Thanks. So I'm going to be talking about oscillatory system, a motor network, in particular the brainstem respiratory network, which I think you'll see is a rather interesting system to analyze a whole variety of problems relating to pattern formation, particularly temporal dynamics and what goes into pattern formation at cellular and circuit levels. My group is the CNS, the Cellular and Systems Neurobiology section, and so I'm speaking on behalf of the group. And just sitting here listening, you can imagine I've gotten very excited about things like breathers. And as you'll see, pacemaker pulse emitters, as you'll see. Bumps, so we have our own electrophysiological and animation version of bumps that I hope to get to at the end. I haven't quite figured out how to get crystal arrays into the analysis yet, but it's potentially coming. Okay, so what I'm gonna do is delve into the system and give you, as an introduction, an overview of how the system is organized and what it is that we're trying to explain in terms of cellular and network dynamics. So what I have here is a highly cartoonized scheme of the respiratory neural control system, and in many senses this can be a caricature of a number of different sorts of motor control systems. But the idea is that we have output elements, which are the motor neurons, which are driving the mechanical apparatus in a motor system. In the case of the respiratory network, it's the diaphragm, the thorax, and as you'll see, a number of muscle groups in the upper airway, which turns out to be important for the analysis that we're going to be looking at. So we're talking about spinal and cranial motor neurons, and there are afferent systems that are providing the CNS with signals about the evolution and stability of the movements that are produced. And we have higher level cortical systems which are interacting with what we consider to be at the core of the system, what's called a central pattern generator. So those of neuroscientists know about CPGs. There's a long tradition of trying to analyze these, but basically what we distinguish functionally in terms of the functional architecture of this entity is there are two functions that are being subserved: rhythm generation, or producing an oscillation. So when you look at the output, and I'll talk a bit more about the output and some of the details in a minute, but basically there's a global oscillation, so it's an oscillatory system. I think you appreciate that breathing is an oscillator, and you understand the importance of it. So there's a global oscillation. If you look at various motor neuron populations, everything is oscillating. But everything is not oscillating necessarily in the same phase. And if we look at the details of the activity that's evolving temporally in a given population of motor neurons, there are temporal details. So that's one of the things that we...
Well, I can stop breathing, right?
Yes. Well, no, you can stop the oscillator, and we'll...
Can you stop the oscillator and stop breathing?
Yes.
Yeah, but don't stop too long.
Right. So just let me amplify just for a second, okay, well, I'll take you.
In terms of information passing through the system,
right,
the number of lines per view doesn't represent the amount of information passing through. I mean, if I would plot the line, is actually from the higher level system, is there a lot of information going down?
There is a lot of, because if you think about breathing, as you said, you can stop breathing, it's under volitional control. And, you know, breathing is not only important for physiological regulation, it's a neural control system, it's also important in behavior. There's virtually nothing that you can do behaviorally that doesn't involve some perturbation of breathing. What I'm doing right now, for example, speech is a highly specialized form of breathing, and it's involving the interaction of cognitive elements, you know, with this basic core machinery here. So yes, there is a lot of information, but there are different states of the system. So you fall asleep and the oscillator continues. under anesthesia is one of the only motor systems that continues to be active in a in an intact animal. In fact, that is a reason why historically it's been possible in an anesthetized animal to probe cellular dynamics in the context of an ongoing behavior, breathing. There's no other motor system in which that's possible. So what's in here are interneurons. So these are networks of interneurons that have all the neural machinery to produce the oscillation and then translate that oscillation into a detailed pattern of activity in space and time. So there are, the oscillation itself is a dynamic pattern that's formed, but there's a more formal translation into a detailed pattern in time and space, and we're going to dissect out how we think that that happens. And one of the way to think about this is it's kind of an autonomous neural machine. And I like to think of these pattern-generating networks as neural machines for behavior. There's a long tradition of trying to isolate these from the central nervous system. So there's a tradition in invertebrate physiology of isolating ganglion with central the leech heartbeat system, the stomatic gastric ganglion system from lobsters. And it's just exploiting this fact that it can function as an autonomous neural machine when you remove all this other neural apparatus. And you'll see how we exploit this in a minute. So let's put some nervous system structure on top of this. So the pattern generation networks are at the level of the brainstem. And so here's the brainstemocentric view of the central nervous system. So right here, this is the brainstem, and in the background here is our two-dimensional manticular sheet of cortex, which is fading into the background here. And it's interesting, and so we're going to actually be talking about regions here, and I'm going to show you a slice through here in a minute, and there's some particularly interesting nodes in the system that represent dynamic hotspots that we're going to analyze. Jack Callan reminded me that a colleague, a close colleague of mine, Jack Feldman, actually worked on this problem as a graduate student in Jack's group. Jack calls this the brainstem problem. So here's the brainstem problem revisited 20-some years later. And I think Jack actually used Wilson-Cowan type equations to try to... Yeah, he was in your group, so... Now, if we take a slice through here, and I'm going to take it in this plane, right through here, and lay this open and take a look at what we're interested in. So now here's just the brainstem looking down on top of it. And there are columns of neurons that are running, if you look over here in cross-section, in what's called the ventrolateral reticular formation. So this is the ventrolateral part of the brainstem. And this is where all the neural transactions are going on, in these two bilaterally distributed columns. There's extensive interconnections between these columns. It's a bilaterally synchronized oscillation. You don't breathe asynchronously along the lines of symmetry of the body. So the idea has emerged that there's some sort of extensively interconnected network that's going on that's producing the oscillation and translating that into a pattern. And the output then from these columns are driving motor neuron populations down at the level of the spinal cord, for example, the phrenic motor nucleus, which is the motor neurons that are innervating the diaphragm. And there are also cranial motor neurons that are mixed in up here that are driving musculature of the upper airway. And I'm going to emphasize that point in a sec. If we take a look at what's going on in these columns, so these are called the ventral columns of interneurons. And it is possible to definitively identify them as interneurons as opposed to output elements by a variety of means. There's an interesting pattern during the respiratory cycle. So here's output from the nervous system. So this is the recordings from the phrenic nerve. This happens to be an adult rat. And so this is inspiration. And here's a cranial motor neuron population, vagal motor neurons. And so these are innervating musculature of the larynx and pharynx. So every time you breathe in, hundreds of milliseconds before there's activity in motor neurons at the spinal cord level, there's a dilation of the upper airway. And this is very important. There's also a stiffening of the tongue. And this is modulating airflow resistance. And in pathological states, it turns out that this is very important. You've heard of sleep apneas and, you know, these things that affect a substantial fraction of the population. What this is a problem in control during sleep because of changes in excitability of components of the network, including the motor neurons of the upper airway. Basically, the tongue prolapses. It's not being adequately driven. It obstructs. And you can actually get into apneic states with rather interesting physiological consequences. So cranial motor neurons, and then they're active during the inspiratory phase, but then there's what's called the expiratory phase. So actually during what you may consider to be passive expiration, you breathe in and you stop. Well, there's actually a lot of neural activity that's occurring during that phase. And it's important in pattern formation. So if you look at one of the cranial motor neuron populations, you see a discharge after inspiration. It continues throughout the expiratory phase. And then it cycles again. And in fact, there are expiratory muscles of the thorax that are active during expiration. So any of you that are runners, if you run and the system is really revved up, there's really active expiration that typically occurs. So you can ramp up the activity during any one of these phases. And if we look at the spiking patterns of interneurons, and this is just a summary of a lot of information obtained from intracellular recordings from neurons along these columns, as well as extracellular probing, we have the inspiratory phase where there's different populations of cells that are active. And they're given, there's a nomenclature, and I'm not going to get into it, but it reflects the fact that there's particular patterns of activation of these populations of cells. So there are cells that start spiking hundreds of milliseconds before you see anything in terms of the motor output. Cells that burst and have a declining spiking pattern during the early part of the inspiratory phase. And in fact, if you look across the entire cycle, there's a temporal dispersion, and it sort of reminds you of propagating activity. I mean, you know, if you might look at this and say there's, it looks almost like a wave, you know, that's propagating, except that's not what's happening. These represent rather synaptic interactions among definable populations of cells, primarily involving synaptic inhibition to actually produce this phasing, and we'll get into this at the end of the talk in some detail. But what we want to explain is the spiking patterns of cells, and in particular this dispersion and this continuous overlap in spiking with phasing. And you know, in the field, people talk about this as being a three-phase cycle. Inspiration, and then there's this period here where cells are active, post-inspiratory, and then it's called stage two expiration. And it's not clear what a phase means mechanistically, because when you start dealing with some of the details of the pattern formation that's going on, it may not be really three mechanistically distinct phases, but it's been convenient to classify it this way. And you can see in fact that there's continuous overlap in the activity of populations of cells. So it's not as if we have a discrete inspiration, post-inspiration, and then, you know, late stage
expiration.
So this is interesting. There is some spatial relationship, but it's not entirely clear. So I'm sort of removing space, and we're looking at temporal dynamics. We can talk a bit. There are hot spots that I'm going to and I'm going to get into that now and consider really what happens first during this phase to produce this sort of temporal dispersion. And there is real geometry that we can put onto that. In terms of, we have these distributed populations of neurons, and one can find discrete regions in which one type of cell population predominates. So if you record in there, you see primarily expiratory neurons. The presumption is that there is the connectivity that's appropriate between for example, those an inspiratory population and an expiratory population spatially distributed. But yet, when you go into local regions, one sees a mixture of cell types. So it's rather interesting. And part of this is a reflection of reticular formation. Reticulum is Cajal's word for this area of the brain. It's not layered. There's no hypercolumns. If you look at it, it's a reticulum, a network. Okay, and it's rather interesting from that point of view structurally. So it's an embedded system where we don't necessarily know all the details yet of the spatial geometry, but we know a lot of detail about the temporal geometry of the system. Okay. So this is just more of a complete pattern of the output, just showing the diaphragm. Here's the activity of the tongue, the hypoglossal motor nucleus, larynx. You can see that they're all active. And here are some details of cranial motor neurons, the pharyngeal motor neurons. And you can see that there's some patterning going on there. And if you look at the integral of the population activity, you can see that there's different dynamics that are happening within each population. But the whole system is oscillating globally, the same frequency. So we have to account for that. So I'm going to organize the rest of the talk around the central debates that are in the field. And these debates are common to talking about any oscillatory system, really. So there's generality to what I'm going to develop. So one is the idea that to produce the oscillation, rhythm generation, it involves a kernel network of excitatory pacemaker neurons. This is obvious. Some specialized cellular properties that are able to produce pacemaker-like behavior. I'm reluctant to use words like kernel in this group, but words like this will come up, and it's an important idea. A network of excitatory neurons producing the basic inspiratory oscillation, where rhythm is an emergent network property. Now, what does this mean? No specialized cellular properties. Intrinsic to the network dynamics is an emergent rhythm. Okay, and it's well known that excitatory networks, under the right conditions, without a whole lot of cellular properties, can produce oscillations on this time scale. So we're talking about an oscillation on time scale of seconds, or faster time scales, involving, however, different mechanisms. And network of inhibitory neurons, where rhythm emerges from inhibitory synaptic interactions. That's been a debate. There's lots of synaptic inhibition that's going on within the network. And I think those of you that have thought a lot about coupled oscillators, you can get a nice oscillation out of populations of inhibitory neurons interconnected, particularly with mutual inhibition. And there's a lot of examples throughout the CNS. So what our working sort of model is that it's all of the above. We have a model that I'm going to develop called the hybrid pacemaker network model. And it's in which the mechanism that's producing the oscillation really depends upon the state of the neurons and network, whether it's a highly reduced system, or we're going to talk about reduced systems, or whether it's embedded in the intact nervous system in vivo, interacting with other CNS elements. And it's a function of neuron and network excitation. So the point is that I'm going to bring home a number of times is that this is a dynamically reconfigurable system depending upon the state of neurons, excitability, and you'll see mechanistically how it's possible to transform mechanisms. So the first part of I'm mainly going to talk about this, and there's good evidence that this is a underlying mechanism, particularly in some states of the system involving specialized cells. So I'm going to take a cut through here and just look at a sagittal plane, project all the cells onto this, and this is a region, so this is a sagittal section of the one of the columns of cells. And one of the ideas that's going to be central to what I'm talking about is that there is a hot spot, a node, which we call the kernel, that consists of excitatory interneurons with pacemaker-like properties, or rather interesting pacemaker properties, that is responsible for producing the rhythmic synaptic excitation that propagates through the system that initiates the inspiratory phase. Yes?
Jeff, just a comment. Sometimes when we look at things like this in the nervous system, the geometrical layout
right.
can be remapped
right.
to exploit how the connections actually
connect right.
them, and that might be very useful yeah. to some of the theorists.
Yeah, there is some mapping, and this has to do with Paul's question. So here's a hot spot of excitatory interneurons. It's called the pre-Botzinger complex. It's something that I discovered in the early 90s. And there are then flanking regions. So these in red, these are expiratory neurons that can be talking. So as I said, there are sub-regions you go in, and there's a predominant sort of neuronal discharge pattern and synaptic interaction patterns. And then here, there are neurons that represent transmission elements that are involved in transmission pathways, so the oscillation is propagating, going down to the level of the spinal cord. But then when you move over spatially, here we see another class of expiratory neurons. So there is some sort of spatial map, and we are trying to sort out that presently. There's another transmission line which goes from ventral to dorsal. So here's the hypoglossal motor neurons which are innervating the tongue. So this is going to be very, very important. But the key thing is that there is a node here in which the cells are critical for the production of the oscillation. And if you go into an animal in vivo, and this has been done now including in a conscious animal, and you lesion this area, you stop the oscillation, the animal dies. Okay? So, yeah. Yeah. They're glutamate, we'll talk about it. They're glutamatergic, and we know a lot about it now. So how do we get at this? So the idea is to isolate the kernel. And we do that by cutting a slice. We cut right through it, take it out of the nervous system, put it in a dish. Okay?
Does the volitional state act directly on that when you stop breathing consciously?
Yeah, so the way to think about this is there's a population of excitatory cells, but there's a tremendous convergent input from a whole variety of control systems there. And also input from flanking regions in this array of cells there as well. And so some of the network configurations that I'm going to show you later have this implicit in the architecture, you know, of the...
Can you superimpose on that picture a picture of inhibitory versus excitatory neurons?
Yeah, no. Because within any given population of cells, whether they're inspiratory or expiratory, you will find that there are both inhibitory and excitatory cells. And this is very important for the way the system works.
Do you have any sense of the micro configuration of those complexes?
No, not yet. And there's a lot of people that are working on this problem, you know, using immunostaining and this sort of thing. And again, everybody, you know, sort of says, well, it's reticular formation. It's very difficult to sort out the architecture. There's a couple of architectures that we know pretty well. For example, these are interneurons. These are what could be called premotor cells. There's a propagation of excitation in this direction. So as a general statement, there's a propagation of excitation in this direction. So there is this sort of feature. But within a local region, there's considerable heterogeneity. Different classes, excitatory, inhibitory. But even within a given class, you'll see...
What's the proportion of excitatory and inhibitory neurons in that?
Well, in a given region, so this is predominantly... contain cells that are expiratory neurons. And we don't know the proportion, and I can't even guess, but it may be important. I mean, if you have some insight into why the proportion.
Well, in the neocortex, the ratio is about things when 80 to 20 or something like that, excitatory to inhibitory.
Right. Well, we think in here that there's a density of excitatory cells,
yeah, for example.
But there are some inhibitory cells that are mixed in.
So do you have any numbers on those densities?
No.
That's a very important parameter of the excitability
right.
of the network.
Yep.
Proportion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we can cut a slice, yeah?
Just a small detail. The pencil method refers to everything in that picture?
Yeah, it refers to everything in this picture, but there are subregions. So there's the pre-Botzinger complex, which is a subregion.
And all these things together
make all. All that make up this, these ventral lateral columns of cells. Yeah?
Did these motor neurons also serve as the interneurons?
Motor neurons? No. Strictly output elements. Not in the mammalian CNS or.
Yeah, these are big pyramidal cells.
Yeah. Right.
The only interneurons will inhibit each other. The motor neuron doesn't inhibit output.
That's right. That's correct. So a lot of the inhibitory interactions are happening at the interneuron level. Yeah. The motor neurons are readout elements, yeah. You know, from the. Well, there are recurrent. I mean, it's interesting. There are some recurrent connections, particularly at the level of premotor neurons. When you get the motor neurons, there's not a whole lot of Renshaw kind of recurrent connections in this system, and it's rather interesting. There are some, but compared to other motor systems. Okay, so to understand how about cutting slices, I mean, what's remarkable about the system is what we showed a number of years ago is that you can actually take the brainstem and spinal cord out of from a neonatal rat and put it in a dish in vitro, and it will spontaneously generate the complete pattern of respiratory neural activity in vitro. And so what you're looking at here is actually a composite of recording. So this is cranial motor neuron populations, tongue, vagus, glossopharyngeal, and then here's all the spinal motor neuron populations, inspiration. You can see some of the patterning going on up here at the level of the cranial motor neurons in particular, and this occurs spontaneously. Preps like this are viable for up to 10 hours, sitting in a dish. And what we do then, we start off with this prep where we know the activity pattern, and then we cut the slice. Okay, so as I progressively reduce the CNS, we always know how the activity in a more reduced state relates to a more intact state. So this is a bridge to the in vivo case, and we know how this activity relates to what happens in vivo. And then as I reduce, and I'm going to show you a couple of reductions of the system, but the nicety is we know how to translate from one state to another. And this is very important. You know, many slices you cut and you have no idea. The remarkable thing about the slices is that they're rhythmically active. Okay, also, and in fact, the slice can be made rather thin. It captures the pre-Botzinger complex where the oscillator is. It also captures a piece of the hypoglossal motor nucleus. So one of the populations of cell motor neurons that were active in the more intact system. And so you can record from local circuit inspiration, and it shows you what the local circuit looks like. Here's the pre-Botzinger complex. There are premotor neurons, transmission cells that get you up to the motor neuron population up here dorsally. These are the axons of the motor neurons that exit the slice here, and that's what we're recording from. So remarkably, there's a local circuit captured along with the engine of the system, and there's a transmission in the plane of the slice through this network. And so it's a local network. And we have a situation then where we can image in the pre-Botzinger complex individual neurons with some optics I'm going to talk about and patch clamp. So we record intracellularly from cells in the context of an ongoing network activity, which is behaviorally relevant. Very important for the analysis. All the processes that we're looking at are endogenously generated and can be analyzed within the context of an active network. And we can also image pre-Botzinger complex. Here is imaging at the population level done with calcium-sensitive dyes. And at low mag, we can look at population dynamics from the imaging. Higher magnification, you can see individual neurons. So these are the somas of neurons lighting up. So you can do cellular interactions. Studies based on optical signals, or you can select multiple cells for recording. Yes?
This is a snapshot.
This is not, I'm going to show you a movie. Okay. And we have excellent cellular and even subcellular resolution. So we get it all. We get population dynamics with the imaging, we get multi-cell, single cell, and in fact what we do is we look the slice with imaging in real time and we select neurons that we want to record from at the cellular level for patch clamping. And
what kind of this is calcium?
Calcium imaging.
And it's done with confocal optics?
So what I'm going to show you is video microscopy for real time. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're looking at individual planes. And here, let me show you a little bit more about the setup. So it's upright, a microscope system. We're doing simultaneous calcium activity imaging. So populations of cells and individual cells. And then simultaneously, we're imaging structurally with infrared DIC optics so that we can say this is a cell that we're interested in. Simultaneously, we have the structural information, and we can patch clamp. So we use this for guided patch clamp. It's video microscopy, so we're talking about video rates, but it's essentially real time. Yeah?
But it's single photon, and it's non-confocal.
And it's non-confocal, but the technology that we're using is intensified CCD technology. Gen 4 optical amplifiers, in which this is all extremely low light level imaging. So we're down at about 0.3% of the light that's coming out of the exciter. We use a xenon lamp and we take it down to 0.3%. We can watch for many, 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 many minutes. There's no photo bleaching, there's no phototoxicity, and we can. So during an experiment, what we do is we're sitting there and we're watching this active network. And we're watching its dynamics and we're making choices about patch clamping cells on the basis of real-time imaging. And we're actually just using the imaging primarily as a way to monitor and identify cells that are active, that is the active components of the network. So we're recording the output and we see all these cells, and let me show you a movie.
So infrared can be very far
infrared? It's near-infrared, yeah. It's about 750 to 900 nanometers. We use different, we exploit the infrared to reduce scattering, and we can look, you know, as deep as we. Yeah. Yeah. But you can see, I mean, this is, in fact, this is this cell. Okay?
So your differential contrast optics for looking at the shadows of the cell membranes at the same frequency range that excites the star. You get both?
No, different. No, different. Okay. And what we do is we have a beam splitter. So there's a dichroic mirror and we split the beam. And so we have a camera that's specialized for IR detection. This is a Nuvicon camera. And then we have a fancy intensified CCD camera that's looking at the fluorescence signals. And actually what we do, it's kind of a neat trick, is we align the images so that we're looking at the same thing in two different spaces, structural space and calcium dynamic space. Okay, and if anybody's interested, I can tell you how we do this. The configuration of the optics for the fluorescent calcium imaging is quite interesting, because what we do is we have the Gen 4 microchannel plate optical amps, and then we have a fiber optic bundle that's connected from the plate directly to the CCD chip via an optical gel, and we have a taper on that so that we adjust the taper so that the image formats from the two cameras are exactly the same. The only difference is the slight disparity, which is very small due to the wavelength differences. Okay.
Question.
Yes?
These are thin slices.
Thin?
You just pick where you want to slice, right?
No, there's only one slice per animal.
To
capture the engine.
Right.
Yeah.
But then you can pick another slice for another, or whatever. But there's no dependence on, I mean, you're seeing, there's no dependence on the other dimension. You're basically seeing through the whole.
So this, what we're actually looking at you know, a number of different focal planes looking into the slice, but we don't see all the way through. The limits of optical resolution are about 90 microns in with these techniques.
But you pick, so you have a slice that's like this, and then through optics you pick a particular
right.
plane.
That's right.
And you're saying, image. Go all the way, but
yeah, currently we have a two-photon system that's a two-photon confocal with a tunable wavelengths,
and
we're trying to go all the ways. We're trying to do a 4D reconstruction. What this is basically is planar view, different arrays of cells up in a different plane, and I'll just show you. I mean,
there is actually a dependence on this transverse direction.
A dependence. What do you mean?
Well, you say you pick the plane.
Right.
Does
that
matter?
No. I mean, the cells are arrayed, and you know, we don't know what the geometrical properties are yet. We just see layers of active cells. Okay, we're reconstructing the
just pick a slice.
Well, so it's one slice, it's cut through there, and it's cut in such a way that we're cutting through the pre-Botzinger complex so that we're laying up on the surface, okay, the viewing surface of the slice, where the action is happening, okay, and it's precise cutting, but we can do it every time, and it works, you know, almost 100% reliable.
What's the dimensions of the pre-Botzinger complex?
Yeah, so in a neonatal rat, which these are from, the cross section is about 200 to 300 microns. So the spherical diameter, and the length is about 250 to 300 microns. Now this translates, so it is really a node in this column of cells. This translates into a much larger neural real estate, obviously in an adult animal, and also the cells are, it depends upon the ones, but they're diameters of about 15 microns in that range, so they're relatively small. They're not big motor neurons, so that's a typical size. Let's take a look. So what I'm going to show you first is low power population level dynamics, couple of cycles. There's sound here. The sound that you're hearing is network activity as recorded at the output, so you can hear. When is the network active? So that's our monitor from the.
So typically, plot on this picture here is about 50 microns. The one you're displaying here.
This is about this one. So I'm going to show you first low magnification, and this is about over a millimeter, and you'll see the locus.
So there are approximately 10,000 cells.
Well, no, because it's heterogeneous. It's not the only system that's in this area. It's a functionally defined region. There's other systems that are mixed in. This is, again, reticular formation. In fact, we think probably for the kernel, and particularly in the isolated state, the numbers of active cells are in the hundreds. So it's very interesting. But, of course, you can make a very robust oscillator.
Yeah.
And it is remarkable that, you know, as I say, you can go into a conscious, awake animal. If you've previously implanted it, and people have recently done this experiment, are there a number of ways that you can actually do cytokilling of these neurons? Jack's group, for example, worked out a nice technique targeting with a toxin NK1 receptors, which seems to be a receptor type that's present on these cells. So you can inject a toxin that goes in there and kills the cells, or you can use other sorts of chemical lesioning techniques. And what happens is, as the cells start dying, the animal, the rhythm becomes very irregular, unstable, and then eventually it stops and the animal dies.
So what do we see is color?
So what? This is a pseudo color, and you're not seeing anything yet. Let's just take a look.
The size, Mr. Smith, I mean, I'm confused. You said the cells are about 50 microns.
These aren't cells.
I'm going to show you first low. You're going to see cells. Okay, I'm going to show you low power. Okay, that's the locus of activity. That's primarily the cluster of cells. And now you're going to see real cells. So this is higher mag. Here's the somas of cells. This is a raw image. Now pseudo color. Now listen to the sound. Okay, now it'll make sense in a minute because I'm going to freeze it and then fade it back on. So these are the somas of active neurons. You see it? Okay. That's calcium imaging. Now, we actually worked out some interesting techniques to label these cells. That's a big problem in calcium. This is not applying it to the bath of the slice and allowing, you know, we have a method of injecting the dyes, and it retrogradely transports back to the somas. It's a very interesting technique. We call it functional neural track tracing. And actually, we've been able to label up the entire network in the slice of different populations of cells based on their axonal trajectories. There was a paper in Nature a couple of years ago, if you're interested, where we describe this. So to get the pre-Boxinger complex cells, for example, we take our slice, we micro-inject. These are dyes that are, it's calcium green. These are AM dyes. That means they're membrane permeable. They permeate the cell axons. So here we have two populations of cells crossing axons. We inject where the axons are crossing. It permeates the membrane of the cell, transports back. And once it permeates the membrane, it undergoes a cleavage and traps. So it's very nice. Not only do we get the somas labeled, as you see here, that's primarily the thing, we also get the synapses labeled, because we get not only anterograde, we get not only retrograde, but anterograde. And then with a confocal system, we're analyzing the synaptic field. So the idea would be, you know, you've got a cell that you can identify based on the somal calcium dynamics. You patch clamp, you fill it then with a second dye, it fills the entire system, and then you look for the labeled synapses. And so you can analyze active synapses on a neuron that's active endogenously, that's embedded in an active network. So that's where one of the things that we're shooting for, as well as this issue that you raised of the four-dimensional reconstruction. Yep.
So in this, can you distinguish interneurons and motor neurons?
Yes, we can from this. And these are interneurons. Again, it's taking advantage of the architecture of the network. The motor neurons at this level don't have crossing axons, primarily. It's an ipsilateral kind of transmission line, but the interneurons. And so, you know, the notion is that we have two coupled populations of cells and we're exploiting that. And there's other ways, actually, to independently label motor neurons. So these are all interneurons that we're talking about.
Another question. Do these hotspots move?
Yeah. There's some things. What's happening here? All right, what do we think is going on in here? We'll talk. There's a dynamic choreography happening, and this we're actually analyzing, looking for waving phenomena and other things. If we want, afterwards we can take a look at the movie again. You can take a look at a longer movie, and what you notice is that each cycle there's a difference in the spatial extent of the activity. This is not like the heart, you know, where there's a dedicated node. We think that, in fact, because of the nonlinear dynamics that are going on, that there's a history dependence. And I'll show you some Poincaré maps a little bit later that get into these sort of dynamics. Yes?
If you measure one isolated neuron, would they identify oscillation?
Yeah, I'm going to show you what individual neurons do in a second. So here's a conceptual model, and this is what I'm going to develop for the notion of the pacemaker network kernel. So we have excitatory interneurons. They have interesting voltage-dependent bursting properties, as you'll see. They're interacting by synaptic interactions. They're excitatory locally on one side, cross-connected to populations. They're heterogeneous. It'll become clear what we mean by this once we take a look at the properties. The synaptic interactions are for synchrony. They're synchronized by synapse, but it's not perfect synchrony, and this is actually interesting. There is this temporal dispersion that's going to happen. You'll see it falls right out of the system as we look at it. Okay, so so this is the kernel idea. Okay, and we've isolated the kernel. And now, if this model is right, there's a very simple test of this. So here we have a slice. We're recording the output of the network, inspiration, inspiration, inspiration. We can record directly from the population activity in the pre-Botzinger complex. We put an electrode and we seal it on. We call it a macro patch electrode onto the surface of the slice on the pre-Botzinger complex. And here you can see the activity nicely.
We're seeing tens of neurons.
Yeah, seeing many, many neurons. This one, population activity, and this is just the integral. So we take the thing and integrate it, and this is population activity. So if there's a kernel there, what should we be able to do? Cut it out, isolate it. Block synaptic inhibition. Does it oscillate on its own? And the answer is yes. So these are now a further reduced preparation that we call the island, the pre-Botzinger complex islands. We just cut it right out. And so we've previously recorded the population activity. Here synaptic inhibition is blocked. The oscillation is a little bit at a higher frequency than beforehand. We've blocked GABA and glycinergic inhibition here pharmacologically. So there's a little tonic inhibition that's going on, but there's some interesting things that develop. Look at this modulation for the isolated system, and there's reasons for this. But this is a very simple, straightforward test of the kernel idea, and you can, and we've actually then taken that and grown it in culture and done some other things with it.
The size of the kernel, you decide by crossing
imaging? Yes, we image first. Image it first when it's embedded. Here is the output of the network. This is, take a spatial integration of the optical signal. Here it is. You can see it's synchronized with the output of the network. Here's the locus of activity, the population level, cut it out. Here's the island. Boom. The locus maps perfectly. Here's the oscillation that continues, but notice now we get some irregularity, and this is because we've made it into a sparse network. We've removed half of the excitatory connections, and there's some interesting dynamics that emerges. Yes?
I mean, in some sense, all this noise on the yellow.
This is optical, so this is...
Right, I was about to say, it's somewhat an artifact of your observation, because this is amazing.
The
purple.
Sure. So this is, I don't have a slide with me that expands this, and the issue of the calcium dynamics came up. The calcium dynamic, the signal has a longer duration than the actual population activity. Again, there's this decay transient that we see, and this is very typical. I should have put up a slide, but it wasn't critical. And what this is, so we are using extremely low light levels. Look at the change in the fluorescent amplitude, our delta F over the ground state, and you know, here we're talking about 2%. This is photon stochastic noise sitting in here. That's why it looks so much noisier. Yeah. But, yeah.
How many neurons?
How many?
Contributing to that electrical signal.
To the electrical signal. That's a network, including the output elements, the electrical signal. But if you record directly, as I mentioned to Jack, we think about 100 hundreds in that range.
I don't understand. That purple signal was not obtained from the same patch?
That purple signal was obtained from the motor neuron output of the slice. So we're not recording directly or optically imaging, it would be in the way, the macro patch. So this is the output of the network. It's the monitor of when the network is active. Burst is the 12th nerve. Burst. And we're imaging simultaneously, flash, like you saw in the movie. And this...
The thing cut off? No,
intact. This is intact first. Intact. Remember the slice... Okay.
It's before you cut it out.
Before we cut it out, yeah. And then here, see this.
You can't go in and just measure electrically the isolated thing?
Yeah, I did. I showed you that in the previous slide where the machine is choking a little bit here. It's a big. So, yeah, here. So here's the isolated thing. We're actually recording population activity. So initially, look, we're recording locally the population activity, and then here's the output of the network, the 12th nerve. And then we cut the thing out. We've lost everything except for the kernel.
That's electrical here.
This is all electrical here.
I got it. That's the answer.
Sorry. Yeah. And any questions like that? Because, these are, if you're not used to looking at these. Now, when you patch clamp on cells, so optically identify the cells, patch. This is what's called a current clamp recording, so you can see membrane potential varying spike. So here's the output of the network, the 12th nerve, okay? So you're used to that by now. Burst. Now you voltage clamp the cell. Why do you do that? Because you can look at synaptic currents that are happening. Okay, and what this says is this neuron that's active is receiving also simultaneously synaptic inputs, and these are excitatory synaptic inputs. You can block these with a blocker of glutamatergic fast synaptic interactions. What happens when you do that? You lose the synaptic currents and the network activity is disrupted. In essence, what we're doing there is, we're testing the idea of excitatory interactions. Let's functionally dissociate the population by blocking all those interactions. And then we've got now a cell that's free from synaptic inputs, and we can ask what are its intrinsic properties, and here they are. Now, this is a current clamp, so we're injecting current. We're holding the current at different levels. We can do anything we want in that regard. And so here we're hyperpolarizing the cell. It's quiet. Now we depolarize it, and this is usually where this particular cell would be sitting. Okay? And look, it oscillates on its own. So this is no truncation here of spikes, so there's a sub-threshold depolarization that'll be clear in a sec. Full spikes. If you apply a little more current to shift the baseline level, it oscillates at a higher frequency, and then it'll transition into tonic spiking. Over this voltage regime, you can tune the frequency by an order of magnitude and frequency, so it's kind of like a cellular level mechanism of frequency control. And what we say about these cells that makes them interesting is that these are multi-state, quiescent, voltage regime for oscillatory bursting, beating. This has significance because when you have a heterogeneous population of these cells, as will become apparent, some cells may naturally be sitting here, some cells may be in this regime, and some may be sitting in this regime. So not all. So when you think about this, don't think of every cell as sitting in there with its own intrinsic oscillatory properties. This turns out to be interesting. And just let me finish, Eberhard. So this is C and QX, but you can also block calcium currents, either with cadmium or remove the calcium, and these oscillations continue just like this, and says, even though these cells have calcium currents, they're getting a shot of calcium, we're using it to image, but that is not critical for producing this oscillation. In fact, there's some sodium currents, very interesting sodium currents, which can account for this dynamics. Okay, so here's the pattern formation at the cellular level. I'm going to tease out the dynamics and tell you how we think this works. Yep.
Enough here, so you don't think there are major issues.
No, we don't think there are. We have some evidence that there are some junctional coupling, but very, very small fraction. Because if you think about it, it's two systems. They got to be synchronized, okay, by long-range synaptic connections as well as local synaptic interactions, right? Yes.
Where would the metric frequency be on the right?
So the slice is probably in here. The slice. Remember the movie Burst? It's kind of slow, right? The reason is that we've reduced the temperature. We can keep those slices alive for 48 hours, sitting in the dish, and the thing will oscillate. So the natural frequency is sitting here at about 0.1 to 0.2 hertz every 5 seconds or 8 seconds.
50 millisecond.
No, I mean the intervals sitting here is between bursts is many seconds. 5 seconds, frequency 0.1 to 1. 10 seconds to 1 second, right? And monotonically tunable.
Per second,
yeah. Yeah, seconds, it's not. Although the action potential is spiking, and we might as well take a look quickly. The action potential spiking is happening, however, on the millisecond time scale. And this is not, we heard about, a coupled oscillator weekly before, earlier in the week, and we're dealing with single spikes. This is a different kind of phenomena. This is a burst of many spikes that are riding on top of a slow process that's producing this sub-threshold depolarization. And then with each burst, there's a decay in the spiking frequency, and if you look over here, you can see it. Here's the spike frequency histogram, this decay. When we do some modeling, this is important for us to match up. A couple of features in the oscillatory bursting regime. Look, it oscillates at a higher frequency, but burst duration is decreasing. Now, this is a signature, a dynamic signature, and important, because I'm going to show you some models that we've developed that are rather interesting that capture this dynamics and on a biophysical, based on a couple of biophysical mechanisms. So what do we do to get at the biophysical mechanisms? We voltage clamp. We're patch clampers. We voltage clamp. We do ramp current voltage relationships. This is the basic signature of the cell, and you can look at it. And there's two components. There's membrane voltage, membrane current, a linear region. We call this the leak. Negative slope region with an inward current, and this is very slow ramps, okay, done at 30 millivolts per second. So slow that the fast sodium currents that generate spikes are completely inactivated here. We're revealing a current that is persistent, okay, in time, because you see a nice inward current of, some cases, hundreds of picoamps with a slow ramp. And look, this is an N-shaped current voltage relationship by stability. This is what you would expect for this. And in fact, here's the current. So what we find is that this current is a sodium current, is TTX sensitive, or this drug riazole can block it. So here's the experiment. Here's the IV curve initially, block with TTX. Look, this inward current is completely gone. Now the leak has been subtracted off here. That's why the baseline is flat. Okay? And subtract the two, and then here's the current right there, and fit it with a Boltzmann function so that you get an idea of what it looks like. So it's a sub-threshold activating conductance, V half of minus 52 millivolts. And in modeling, this is the Boltzmann that we're after for the steady state activation. Okay. Any questions about this? So you take these cells. Now, I should say that with regards to heterogeneity, not all cells have this much inward current. There's the variations in that amplitude. The Boltzmanns all look the same. They all collapse if you normalize. It is a normalized function, but the amplitude of the current. And so cells that don't burst necessarily, that don't have enough inward current in relationship to the leak, and you'll see why. You got that? All right. How do we prove that this current is important? Here's a nice way to do it. We use a blocker of the current. Here we've isolated a cell, its intrinsic oscillations. You block the current, so you're washing it in. It takes 10 minutes or so to block the current at a time where the current is blocked. Look, as the current is progressively blocked, the intrinsic oscillations are slowing down, stops when the current is blocked, but the cell can still spike. So we haven't done anything to the fast sodium current. That's important. Okay, we just block this persistent current that's distinct from the fast sodium current.
Chad, this persistent current is also TTX sensitive.
Yes. And this, by the way, this persistent sodium current, TTX sensitive, is all over the place. It's a neocortex. It's starting to show up as being a major player in cellular dynamics and pattern formation. And I'm going to show you some movies about how this works. Turns out the critical thing is the inactivation kinetics of this current that is regulating the cycle dynamics. At the population level, how do we get at this to show that this current is important? You see it at a single cell level. The real problem is the causality. Okay, I've got a cell. How do I? Slowly inactivating. So when I say persistent,
relative to the fast.
So what we do is we're imaging, calcium imaging, get the hot spots, the locus, put in micropipettes, slowly infuse in the blocker of this conductance. This is a long time-based stretch, so each one of these little spike-like looking things is actually the envelope of population activity. It's just on this time scale. So here's population activity recorded either on the output side of the network as the monitor. In micro-infuse, the amplitude goes down a bit. It's the rhythm is slowing down. It stops. You can reverse it. And this just shows you in a little bit of an expanded time base what's going on during one of these experiments. So here's the population activity. Infuse, it's slowing down. This is entirely expected based on the dynamics that I'm going to show you. And then when you block the current completely, the network activity stops. So that's our causality argument that links the cellular biophysics to the population activity. This is not the only thing that's going on, but this is important, and this is the sort of demonstration that you need if you're trying to link the cellular properties to the network dynamics. Is this clear? Unfortunately, we have blockers of this current. We've actually found, for those of you that are interested, that low concentrations of TTX selectively block this current. Higher concentrations block the fast sodium current. There's a very nice kind of less than 50 nanomol.
Have you found other persistent currents?
No, not yet. We're looking for other interesting currents. In this population of cells, as isolated in the slice, the kernel, That's the name. There's some question about whether there's a nonspecific cation in conductance. There's this thing called a can current, if you know your currents, from the, that may be involved in some cells. In fact, Nino Ramirez from Chicago has some information. So a lot of people have adopted this approach that we came up with, and a lot of people are slicing and patching, and the issue is we're trying to, and so Nino's got some information that he finds these cells, but there may be another population of cells that has pacemaker-like properties, and it may be can current dependent. So this is interesting. We're trying to look at that, and it may be there's some differences in the way. It doesn't matter. They do their experiments. So we've built models. So how can we understand what's going on here, the cellular dynamics? Okay, so biophysically minimal models. Butera and John Rinzel and I worked on this for a number of years trying to understand the dynamics. I'm just going to summarize some features. These are Hodgkin-Huxley, I like that, ionics. Built in, and the thing is, so we have spiking, and we have, remember the current voltage relationship leak? It's a potassium sort of dominated leak, and then we have this persistent inward current, and I'm going to show you in some detail. It has very slow inactivation, so when you look at the inactivation parameter, H in the Hodgkin-Huxley style equations, very slow inactivation. Now, this is meant to be biophysically minimal. The reason that we were doing this is we were asking what is the sort of minimal biophysical mechanism to understand this rather complicated voltage-dependent behavior. Multi-state, you know, order of magnitude, tunable range and frequency. There's a lot of detail dynamically in that. And how do we understand it? So basically the models mimic the current voltage relationship that we measure. And we don't add other currents initially. And these are all standard equations. What will come up later in the current equation is synaptic currents. So there's two types, tonic and aphasic, that's due to the interaction among cells. And the synaptic dynamics are here. John Rubin talked about some synaptic dynamics, which is kind of like this, in which the synaptic variable is a function of presynaptic voltage. So every time a presynaptic cell fires, you get a fast excitatory event, and this is the time constant, which is appropriate for fast glutamatergic synaptic interaction. So we're going to be talking about big arrays of cells soon.
Depressing synapses or?
No depressing. These are all excitatory. We haven't added this. Is, yes? AMPA, yeah. 9-NMDA. Remember the CNQX experiments? You block the... So we've done a lot of synaptic physiology on this. It's AMPA kinate, non-NMDA is what they usually classify that to distinguish it from NMDA, which has, as you know, different dynamics. And a couple of interesting things here to reduce the models down as much as we could. So there's only three state variables here, and the thing is, this is done by taking a look at the time scale. It's time scale arguments. The inactivation is slower than, much, much slower than the activation, so you can go to infinity, and there's some other things, which is classic in the field. This has been done by a lot of people. But here I just want to show you the contrast, this current, the fast sodium current, and here's its Hodgkin-Huxley portrait for steady state inactivation and activation versus the persistent current. And so, you know, as we said before, steady state activation is sub-threshold to where the fast sodium current is activating. But look at this time constant. Up to 10 seconds for inactivation. It's voltage dependent, but where the cells are living in the voltage regime, very slow. And we built alternative models where we had a completely persistent current. And then, of course, if you do that, then you have to have other currents. We had a voltage activated slow current, which have to, you need to terminate the burst, basically. The slow variable is the one that's going to do it for you. And it's the recovery of the slow variable that, in fact, is going to dominate the dynamics of the cycles. This is standard fast variable, slow variable. The slow process, okay, is important, but it's set up by an ionic conductance mechanism, this neat persistent current. And I've asked the channel biophysicists about this. Is this possible? I mean, you know, what mechanism can you think of at the channel level that gives us? And I said, yeah, it's possible. There's a certain type of inactivation, structural reorganization. At least Rick Aldrich told me he doesn't.
I don't know, but couldn't there be a resonant phenomenon where, because of the shape of the inactivation time constant, it attracts the network to sit at a certain frequency and keep the cells around a certain voltage?
Attracts the network. Well, you have to understand that when the cells are embedded in the network, there's more than just this conductance going on. There's synaptic current that's being injected that's controlling it and synchronizing the cells. So I'm not sure about attracting.
Looking at that curve and wondering.
Yeah, well, I'm showing a lot of curves with shapes and dynamics, and maybe somebody's going to say something, you know, like this that enables us to.
These curves basically are a summary of your experimental.
Yes, these are summary of experimental. It's the model. The model's consistent with it, and in fact, the model. This is the behavior.
The model's designed to.
Right. It's designed, but it's interesting from a modeling exercise the way we did this. Before we knew a whole lot about the current, we actually built the models.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and the models captured the essence of the dynamics, and we said.
The choice of the logistic function and the Posh function that
was
done. Those were done before you had to.
And that's when we were able to get the Boltzmann, and you know, then and it's like, bam! Wow, this is amazing because it's the fits, and it makes sense. And you'll see, look here. Here's the behavior in a simulation at single cell level, the multi-state behavior. So all we're doing is a current clamp simulation, and here's the tuning of the oscillatory frequency. So it captures the multi-state behavior. Look at the burst durations.
What about themselves?
Yes.
Are you going to talk about
them? Yeah, but it depends upon what feature that you're interested in. So, I mean, for example, the spiking during the bursts has, at a given state, you know, a declining spike frequency, which is the feature of the data, if you remember.
Yeah.
And as you
by spike frequency
action, but
you mean the interspike interval,
yeah,
inverse of the interspike interval. There's no frequency. Right.
Well, it's the period between action potentials. So yeah, whenever the period.
So Paul's question.
Okay, this falls into what's called square wave burster, type one.
This is one of the 96.
Type one, relaxation type oscillator. You'll see it, but it's a little bit interesting. It's a little bit different, though, than the classic one, particularly the way the system behaves when you transition from here to here. A lot of square wave bursters, and again, it depends upon the ionics, you start pushing them up like that, they'll actually slow down in their oscillation, the burst duration will increase, and in fact, what will happen is, you know, there's some very interesting stuff that happens in the transition, and these are a little bit different. These are smoothly tunable, but nonetheless, they fall into this. And you can think of it as a relaxation oscillator. Yes?
So, I mean, if you look at a single burst, you can analyze.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's interburst, interspike duration, and then dispersion of these interspike, whatever, of durations and all that. And did you tune your model to get that right? Did you test your model to see whether it's right, or did you not?
No, we're not doing that yet. It's a higher sort of level kind of consideration.
Not to be too important to get that.
Well, it could be.
There's a lot of dynamics inside.
Yes.
First.
Yes, absolutely. So there's an oscillation basically at a faster time scale riding on a slower oscillation.
Right,
absolutely.
It's own.
Yeah, it does.
Order and dynamics and all that, and you just haven't. It's roughly right.
No, roughly, yeah. Biophysically minimal. These cells, this is not all these cells have. It's almost, and there's no neuron that only has four conductances.
And you don't believe that getting that completely right is necessary to get the other?
Not until I know all the conductances that can affect the supra threshold behavior. So how much of an A current is there
not until you know, you won't be able to get it right.
Right.
But whether it's important to get it right or not,
yeah, we don't.
With your knowledge.
Right. Well.
Well, it's unlikely to be all that important. It's on a much faster time scale than restoration.
Right. Right. But there's information encoded in the spiking. That's what signals through the system, and it's the underlying slow oscillation that's organizing the signaling for the circuit, right?
And it's the latter thing you're looking at now.
Huh?
It's the latter thing.
Yeah, we're interested in this multi-state behavior, some features of the profile. You know, first order, you know, kind of stuff. You know, the declining spiking, the change in the burst duration, but not yet. There's some analysis that we're doing about, but it's.
Should we view that as the bursts disappear when you depolarize it, the inactivation goes so fast that the persistent sodium becomes less important? Is that what we should take?
Well, there's an oscillation in H, and I'm going to talk about this. And the burst termination occurs when the sum of the inward currents flips to outward, and it's the leak plus the persistent sodium. And so it is, during spiking, there's an incremental inactivation, voltage dependent, of the persistent current. You'll see it adds up. I'll show you a movie of it.
There's a real macroscopic change in its dynamics around these very narrow changes in voltage. So there's some physical separation in currents that are associated maybe with the persistent that are now being overwhelmed by another combination of currents compared to the singlet behavior?
No. Mm-hmm. So what happens... Let's get into that, because I'm going to talk about that, and we can address it in a minute. I wanted to mention this because for the physicists and mathematicians, there's a really interesting technique that one can use to test ideas like this. It's called the dynamic clamp, and some of you have heard of it. We have our own version that we developed in the lab with Butera. This is actually a little bit out of date. If anybody's interested, I can give you the reference. It's published. What you do is you synthesize in the computer any sort of conductance that you want to. You hook the computer up to a patch clamp amplifier, you record through a patch pipette the voltage, and then you compute the current that would exist if a conductance was really there, and you inject it, and you do it so fast the cell doesn't know that it doesn't have the conductance, so you can artificially incorporate a conductance into a cell. In fact, we have a system based on real-time Linux that's so fast you can put many conductances in. You can build whole models of cells with multiple conductances with fast and slow kinetics and put them in to the cell. And I'd be more than willing to talk. It's going to come up again. You can even run models inside the system in real time and interact them with real neurons. And I'm going to show you an example of that. You guys are showing me all your mathematical bags of tricks. I'm showing you some interesting experimental bags of tricks here. But the... So what you can do with this technique is, you know, you can put artificial conductances in the neuron to test the electrophysiological roles, or you can actually add artificial synapses on the cells, and you can couple neurons to model networks and study, you know, network dynamics. It's fast. This is real-time computing going on here, and it's getting better and better. We're pushing it up to 100 kilohertz throughput rates. Can't wait to implement it on our G5s. So this is a very powerful technique for interfacing models with real neurons. People talk about the interface between computers and the brain. This is really an interface in that regard. And so there's lots that you can do with this, and we're doing some interesting experiments. And the thing that's interesting in relationship to your question is, you know, one can sit there, then you're patch clamped on a real neuron, and you want to ask, what are the details important, you know, about the various dynamics? You just shift the dynamics around, you see how the neuron is responding. If you're clever and you know how to do the experiment, you can cancel out conductances with this. So it's a way to test. I'm going to show you a simple test of the persistent sodium conductance mechanism based and also based on our model. The test, is the model right? So what do? We take a neuron that doesn't have these voltage-dependent bursting properties. We select in our circuit a motor neuron, a mundane. So look, all it can do is it's quiescent, so we're just injecting current, one of these current clamp experiments, shifting the baseline, and then it'll transition into tonic firing. So what are we going to do? We'll put our model persistent sodium current into the neuron, and what happens? Immediately transforms into a multi-state voltage-dependent burster. Okay, and we scale the conductances to the capacitance so that we get the current densities right, and we compare it to the actual simulation of the model, and it's pretty good. So here's the real neuron, and so here's the burst period now as a function of baseline membrane voltage. So we're depolarizing the cell, and the bursting frequency is going up. And there's isoplefs, you know, one can do as a function of different initial values of the persistence. So I didn't show you all the parameter space for these models, but it's interesting. And what we were looking for is this kind of a trend. So we've scaled the current densities. So we're not going too badly. This is not a trivial experiment to do. But I think this is the wave of the future. Who talked about, so first we had voltage clamping, then we had patch clamping, now we have dynamic clamping. It's really where it's going to be happening. But the good news for us, you know, is that it's the way to interface models directly with neurons, okay? So here's the what's happening dynamically during a burst. Here's the H parameter, the inactivation parameter. During a burst, incremental increase in inactivation. This is the sum of the subthreshold currents from the current voltage relationship. So what does it mean? Transiently, there's a big jump in these currents during spiking, but there's an envelope. You see it here, it's like a decaying envelope. And what's going to happen? When is this thing going to stop bursting? It's when the sum of the subthreshold currents flips from net inward to net outward. And it's all being controlled by the fact that inactivation is proceeding. And then we'll reach a state at which the sodium, inward sodium current is low enough, and we have a kind of like an ohmic leak, that the current balance is going to flip and termination occurs. But what is going to regulate the inner burst interval? It is the recovery from the inactivation. What's interesting is that, look, remember the time constant could be as long as 10 seconds for recovery from inactivation. The dynamics of the cycle are such that we're talking about 5 seconds, so this current is never fully inactivated. It's sitting there, and H is oscillating up and down. That was what is regulating the dynamic. So all of this dynamics comes out of the properties of this current.
So a little integrating fire network with a recovery variable.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Any kind of slow variable that's doing this. Let me show you a model, a movie of the dynamics. So here's H. We're going to watch it dynamically. Here's voltage. Here's the subthreshold currents, and here's the instantaneous current voltage relationship, and the yellow ball is where we're sitting on the instantaneous IV curve of the cell. And let's take a look. Okay. Net inward current, so this is the sum of the subthreshold currents. This is just what we looked at before. This is the transients during the spike, so we're in the bursting phase, the incremental increase in inactivation during the dynamics. And you'll see the flip, and it's interesting because of the stable points that you can see on the instantaneous subthreshold IV curve. So this is time going along, so we're bursting about 600, we're approaching 700 milliseconds. We're migrating up. Look what's going to happen. We flipped. There's a stable point right here. I sped it up so that we don't have to wait. We're not going to get anything until we're on the bistable region again due to the migration of the current voltage. So this is the dynamics visualized. Okay, let's get out of this. We got to hurry up if we want to get anywhere. So let me talk about synaptic coupling and network dynamics. So we'll get a pattern formation at the network level now. So the idea is that we got this excitatory network, and this is where we're going to start, and we want to model this. We take our cellular models, build network, models. And what is evidence, first of all, for the synaptic coupling, this excitatory synaptic coupling? It's important. I showed you the block with CNQX, but there's other ways that you can go about it using the imaging, for those of you that are interested in the imaging. So we image multiple neurons, 1, 2, 3, so they're flashing. We take a look at their calcium transients. We do cross-correlations on the optical signals. So we can do multi-neuron recording and cross-correlations. So here's the case. So initially, the network is intact. All the cells are synchronized, cross-correlation, nice peak, near zero time lag. And block these excitatory interactions, flat correlation, you can just see it right here. They start drifting apart for those cells that remain active. So notice this cell went silent. It's one of the cells that doesn't have the intrinsic bursting. So this shows you kind of what the natural frequencies are. These two cells, it just so happens, settled down into something pretty close to each other. So this is something that we're doing. You can read about the details of this set of an, yes?
Will it be possible in the future if you could talk to the cells optically? Talk? By using cage substances?
Yeah, we could talk to them.
Caging things instead of the cell.
Yeah, we could do that. But
coming in with light improvements that are focused on.
Yeah, we're. Yeah. But, yeah, we could do that. I mean.
We could have a larger field. It might be easier than using.
Right. Right. But this we don't, this is completely non invasive. We're just imaging and real, video rates. And so it's a nice. I just showed this because it's a nice thing that you can do with optical signals, and you can do lots of pairs, and we've done lots of pairs. And you know, this doesn't mean that these two cells are actually talking to each other. It just simply means that they have temporally synchronized input. So I'm not implying that this is. In fact, the way we figure out who's talking to whom, we're just getting into this, is if you're at the Society for Neuroscience meeting, we've developed robot systems now that will actually, based on images, go down and put patch pipettes on multiple cells in a given focal plane.
What is the anatomy of the of this complex, the connectivity?
Yeah, so we think it's certainly not all-to-all, but I'm going to show you some all-to-all models. You think it's sparse, and we think it's probably, the connection probability may be pretty low. It may be like 0.3 to 0.4 or something like that. That's our guess, but we don't know. We got to do pairwise patch clamp to figure this out, and we are. It's a nice paradigm. So you image here, what do? So this is what we're trying to do to give you some insight into the way.
30% are directly connected.
Well, if I have this cell, the probability that this cell is connected to this cell is 0.3.
That sounds one of the highest I've heard. Well, no, it's not the highest. It's pretty high.
Well, these cells are pretty well synchronized. But you don't, as a term, you don't want the synchrony to be too tight. So look, what we're doing is you have a field like this, you're imaging, you patch clamp on one cell, and you ask who's it connected to in the field, and so you just depolarize it and get it to start spiking and see who lights up. Yep.
Approximately how many synapses are on one of these cells?
Well, given that the envelope of synaptic drive that happens when the network's active is hundreds of picoamps. 1,000, that order. I mean, we were trying to use the imaging to get at this. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to be done with regards to the spatial properties here, which is the challenge for the future. And it takes, because of the region of the brain, it's not layer 4 or whatever, it's reticular formation. This thing is just embedded in there, and things are interacting. It's kind of cool. In one sense, you can think about some spatial invariance in the thing and just worry about the temporal dynamics. But on the other hand, there's got to be something very important in the architecture. And
you talk about the probability of connection,
right? And then there's the weights, the synaptic, the strength. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to get into this right now. So synaptic coupling. I gotta push on here. What this is the first thing that we did to start looking at the dynamics of models in networks, two-cell, identical cells, reciprocally coupled by excitatory interactions, with a tonic excitation to regulate the excitability, the membrane potential. So this is a slice of parameter space. We're looking at one neuron, It's symmetric, so one neuron is doing the same thing, except when you get into the spiking regime where they're 180 degrees out of phase, which is interesting dynamics. So I can look at one. So look, they're not coupled together, break this, and this is our isolated case, multi-state behavior. Couple them together, increase the excitability a little bit, couple them together, and look what happens. As I increase the strength of the coupling, the oscillation slows down and the burst duration increases. So there's a case that you might not intuit beforehand. I increase excitatory coupling and the network starts slowing down. Okay? There's a model. Model. Yeah. All the population stuff now I'm going to be talking about. Simulation to get a look at some of the dynamics, and there's a lot of interesting stuff.
Well, the drive is stronger, so the inactivation is stronger.
Pushes it up further along its inactivation curve, and yeah, it's a consequence of the dynamics of the interaction between the synaptic current that's being injected to the cell as the activity and this kinetics of the...
Yeah, the recovery.
You're exactly right. Exactly right.
So when you talk about model,
yeah.
What parts of that model are then experimentally verifiable, like things like that?
Well, yeah, I'm going to show you how we verify. I try to verify everything except when we get to the big population level dynamics. And the only thing that we have to do is there to verify some things is look at. Okay, so this is an interesting piece of the dynamics. This just shows kind of a map of these dynamics, the two fundamental parameters, the synaptic coupling strength that you were asking about, and the tonic excitation on the cell. And this is just what that slice of parameter space told us. So, you know, as the coupling strength increases, there's a whole range of, you slow down the network, basically, the burst periods. But there is one thing interesting that I wanted to point out about the dynamics here. There are regimes of parameter space, of which this is just a slice, where, look, if you uncoupled the cells, they would be sitting there tonically spiking, but now you couple them together in a network and the system oscillates. So already, it tells you that network dynamics are doing something for you, are doing a lot for you. And in fact, so this would be called kind of an emergent oscillation. So how do we test this experimentally? So we go back to our dynamic clamp, and here's an interesting experiment. We have two neurons. We have the incomputo neuron. We have so our cell oscillating away
in silico.
But I like incomputo. So sitting there, bursting and oscillating away, and we've patch clamped on a real neuron, and the neuron itself doesn't have any oscillatory bursting properties. It's just a mundane one of these mundane cells. But here we're running. So now I make an artificial, I put an artificial persistent sodium current into this neuron and it starts oscillating away. Yeah, this is an isolated cell. The baseline is pretty noise free, I don't see. So
put that current in the incomputo.
Well, we put it in the real neuron.
Through the patch.
Yeah, through the dynamic clamp system.
Except it's not a real current, it's your computing current.
Right. It's a artificial current put into the cell to turn it from this into an oscillatory burster, because we want to make a little network and test the dynamics. So look, now we make artificial synapses. So we make an artificial fast excitatory synapse from our model onto the real neuron. So it's bursting. We make an artificial synapse back to the incomputo in silico cell. This one. And now we look at the dynamics. So look what happens as soon as we couple them together. So in this experiment, we can vary the coupling strength and we can do all this stuff that we might want to do to look at this dynamics. And you can see you couple them and look, it slows down and the burst duration increases. Here's a one-way coupling to show you the synaptic currents that I'm injecting into the cell. Okay, so this experiment works. I've made a little network.
You realize that in the far future, humans are going to be coupled to dynamic clamping.
Yeah. Well, I can see there's usefulness to dynamically clamping people. I have.
I don't think I want to depend on the
Okay, so look. Here's the recreation of the experiment. Model neuron where we've added different coupling strengths. Okay, so I'm trying to look at burst period as a function of the synaptic conductance. So this basically the system slows down. You see the trends in the pure model. It's not perfect because it's, you have to understand, it's very difficult to patch clamp on a neuron and on the fly start scaling all these current densities. This is an interesting experiment to do. But anyway, I mean, it gives you an idea of how we can test these ideas. All right, now let's get to larger networks, and we'll get into some interesting things. So what do? We take 50 to 500 cells. Here's uncoupled heterogeneous. What does this mean? We distribute parameters like the leakage reversal potential of the conductance or the amplitude of the persistent sodium current as a heterogeneity parameter. So here's what the raster plot looks like, and I've pulled 3-4 cells out to show you that some cells are in their spiking mode naturally when it's uncoupled, no synaptic coupling here, bursting with different natural frequencies of individual cells, and you can see that a substantial fraction of the population of these 50 cells here is bursting. So here's the raster plot, burst. And now we throw on the fast excitatory connections, and I've arrayed the cells so that we can see, in starting the cells that are sitting up here initially down the cells here. And look what happens as soon as we throw on the excitatory synaptic connection. This is all to all, by the way, as a first blush pass at it. What happens? Out comes this dispersion of activity. Okay, and here you can see in the raster plots, cells spiking hundreds of milliseconds before others. Now, what does this represent? I have an animation of this, but I can show you, but I didn't plan to. Where, what happens is you get bunches of cells that are active early. There's a spreading wave of synaptic excitation that's moving through the population. It causes a synchronized population level burst, and the persistent sodium current really helps you here. Why? Because a lot of the cells are sitting. This is a nonlinear amplifier. You kick it a little bit, it's got this threshold activation property. It's a great way to synchronize populations of cells. But you get this temporal dispersion on the onset side, but look at the offset side. All synchronous. You start injecting synaptic current into these cells, and for the reasons that we discussed before, the whole population will shut down. So this current can buy you a lot at the network dynamic level. Very interesting. Phase termination, temporal dispersion. The temporal dispersion, I think, is very important because it's like a priming wave that's moving through. Now, with regards to imaging, we're trying to look for this wave and also to try to understand if there's anything more complicated going on. Real spatiotemporal propagation sort of stuff. Waving, waves and other things that may result from this kind of a system.
What about G? You've got a single G.
The G sin, yeah, the coupling, is also distributed.
Yeah.
Also.
But not according to some geometry.
No. No geometry. All to all coupling, no geometry.
Well, it could be all to all, but the amount, yeah, the strength of the coupling
could be
depend on
random. So we use a random generator.
Right.
Random. In the absence of any other information. But
right, so that's one of the things that if you're looking, yeah, for spatial patterns, they must. Would presumably arise out of the geometry.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
so
you see
subclusters of synchronized. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Everybody. This is going to give rise to some interesting things.
Did you put in delay in the coupling?
Well, it's kind of built in the sense that the synaptic coupling dynamics with S parameter is a function of presynaptic voltage. So there's kind of a, but there's no propagation. No, we haven't put in propagation delays. And I don't think it's necessarily going to affect the dynamics that we're talking about. Yeah?
Are individual cells synchronized between different neurons?
Yeah, I mean, well, here's the whole synchrony thing. So, no. Now this is interesting. In the symmetric case, the two-cell model, they're actually out of phase. Now in the population, I don't know what the dispersion is going to be in there. In fact, the last time I was teaching at Woods Hole and Bard and I put this model up on XPP and Bard said, let's take a look at some of the dynamics and the spiking phase, and you know, one of the things that falls out in the symmetrical case is anti. Yeah. Here's a sync rate. So heterogeneous, we set up the distribution so that the activity modes are roughly equal across the population. Silence bursting, beating. No coherent network activity, but there's lots of cells sitting back oscillating. Couple them up synaptically. Now here's the sum of the voltage, average voltage, or the spike, add up all the spikes. Either way, you get population activity out of the network. And you can see that it syncs up. But again, you get this dispersion that's happening. We've also looked at frequency control, which is important. Now add some tonic excitation. Remember our two-cell model. Now this is applied to the population model, and we even have follower population that we can look at. This dispersion, by the way, propagates through the network. So these cells don't have these properties. They're just readout elements, followers. This is where all the action is. Here's the pacemaker population activity. Okay. Frequency control, increase the tonic excitation, tune the whole network over an order of range frequency. This is how you do it. And experimentally, we do this by changing tonic excitation, by changing the potassium level. It's a simple way to elevate, in a tonic way, the excitatory level. You can tune the population burst frequency. So this is a recording from the pre-Botzinger complex in a slice directly. This works for a island also. Here's the integrated population activity. So as I increase tonic excitation, the frequency goes up. The dynamic portraiture we capture in Poincaré maps, and there's reasons for doing this. I'm not going to elaborate, but we can talk about it afterwards. What we're doing is the area underneath these curves. It also works for the mean amplitude. Low states of excitability, limit cycle oscillation, single point on a Poincaré map. Actually, as the excitability increases, you get multipoints, reproducible. We call this mixed mode oscillation or multi-periodicity. Push it a little bit further, we get rings. Spatial statistics shows that we have a real hole here. We get a ring, push it even further up, and we can start getting formless maps, even though a very deterministic sort of behavior that's happening. I have a bunch of examples that are nice, but we interpret this as possibly. And what we're doing with this, and it has to do with synchrony, subpopulations are breaking up, causing there to be a modulation of the fundamental period. And that's why you start getting amplitude fluctuations, because the output of the population reflects subpopulations.
Harmonic resonance.
Yeah. I've got some nice examples, and when you run the model this way, you can also get some similar dynamic maps. Here we're just changing EK to mimic that experiment, like tonic. Limit cycle, get rings, and we don't yet understand all this, because this looks like the classic stuff from fluid dynamics, the quasi-periodic transition to chaos. Rule and Tockens originally, I think, were the first people to discuss this. This well-defined pathway tuned for us, and this amazes us, by a single variable, excitability, moving the system from, you know, stable limit cycle periodicity through, you know, a multi-periodic state to maybe this quasi-periodicity to maybe something else when you get up here. So usually the systems go through the quasi-periodic transition right before they get into aperiodic activity. Not necessarily, but I'd like to hear some comments, at least in some of the systems. I know it's not absolutely required, but
it's not even in any way.
It's very special.
Right.
Period doubling.
Is it? Or, well, we don't.
It's, you're talking about quasi periodic.
I'm talking about the quasi periodic. I'm not talking about. That is special. Okay. Okay, good. So I would like to talk a little bit more. Somebody asked me, can serious mathematics be inspired by this? John Rubin and Dave Terman actually analyzed the synchrony conditions in asynchrony. I'm not going to talk about it. I'll just point you to this. They have some nice stuff. And here's the knees of the nalclines that John was talking about, and synchrony conditions, but then a breakup of the population. Some cells just can't get over the knee. And so these are left behind. This is actually a 2-to-1 case. And they have nice solutions for the, they call these snakes, there's maps of the H, that's our inactivation as a function of the heterogeneity parameter. So they analyzed this system inspired by what we did. Their models were simpler, the no spiking, just relaxation oscillators, coupling, strength varied, so they went through all the parameters. They've got some nice analytical solutions for the conditions necessary for synchrony and asynchrony. Okay, so I just want to talk a little bit quickly, I'm running out of time, I'm going to cut it off, of conditions for emergent oscillations. You can take individual cells, push them out of the range where they can burst, so you can push cells down to that, all they can do is spike or be silent. That's because the ratio of the conductance of the persistent sodium to the leak is really what determines it. Remember those two basic parameters. There's only a range of these parameters where bursting will occur, and under those conditions, so below the critical value, at least for the model, 1.8, no heterogeneous network, no oscillation emerges, but now synaptic coupling strength does it for you. You start increasing the synaptic coupling strength and you get a purely emergent oscillation without cellular oscillatory behavior present. Okay? So I'll quickly talk about pattern formation in the last couple of minutes and the notion of how we get patterns and inhibition. And now I'm going to develop, in a full sense, what we call the hybrid pacemaker network model. So now it's the embedding problem, we call it, the embedded thing. Again, I hate to use such terms, but we embed it back into the column of cells and we're trying to account for the pattern. This is what we talked about before, this inspiration and expiration. How do we do it? Here's our kernel. We start off, here's the properties with temporal dispersion, cells spiking early. So here we have it under tonic control, but it's the same kernel we've been talking about. We put it inside of a monster network. don't get too concerned yet, but it's a concept. Excitatory interneurons in the transmission line, inhibitory interneurons require for pattern formation. Okay? The idea is that once you overlay the inhibition on this network, it takes this basic pattern here and transforms it into the three phases, if you want to call it that, or the four, and why, and what's interesting about it. Okay, so here's the pattern forming network. What's embedded in this, and I'll say that this model is based on what we know from intracellular recordings in vivo, of recording the inhibitory waves. You look at a given cell, there are wave after wave after wave of inhibition that's coming in, and it suggests a functional connectivity. This is not an architecture that's been established definitively. It's a functional architecture where we're trying to account for taking the kernel, embedding it back in the system, taking the basic activity of the kernel and transforming it, right, into the full pattern. That's because embedded in there is just simply a ring structure with reciprocal inhibition. Those of you that know coupled oscillator theory, this is, as you put tonic excitation on this, will generate three phases of oscillation, right? And so there are some cellular properties that become important in this, and I'm not going to talk about it, but just to mention tonic excitation, and now when we embed it back in, and just let me tease it apart, so the kernel, an excitatory line, if without all this inhibition, it's just going to reflect what the kernel is doing, what it's propagating through, but as soon as we overlay the inhibition, we get the transformation. And the fact that this has a ring means that this is an oscillator too, so it's a coupled oscillator system, and it's dynamically getting pretty more complex. But we've actually simulated this based on what we consider to be the set of currents that's a postulate, sort of master set of currents, including the persistent sodium. So here's simulations. You get the full pattern of activity coming out. You can get modes where you make the cells inactive and then the ring, so I've simplified the model. So you'll get an oscillation coming out that's basically three-phase, and it's based on the ring dynamics. Or you can transition the cells in the one oscillator into beating, okay, and so now they're, because of the multi-state behavior of the cells, it'll dynamically transform, it'll still oscillate, and it's because of the embedding really involves the dynamic control via inhibition back on. So this is a recurrent, it's kind of recurrent, but there's a structure to it. But the principle that I just want to point out, dynamically configurable, transformable. And what I'm going to show you is a movie to end it. And it's just going to be a movie of these cells plus a tonic excitation and a readout element. And it's going to be the network dynamics. I want to end it so that I'll just show you that because... QuickTime movie. So this is our bumps. This is how we represent bumps. Okay, so what you're going to see here in the movie is the ring. So the ring structure will turn out to be here, here, and here. This is our kernel. This is our tonic excitation. And this is the readout element. Okay, and we've encoded. This is population activity from a big simulation. Kind of looks like a Mexican hat, doesn't it? I like Mexican, but it's not a Mexican hat. What this is, it's a virtual elastic surface, and it's being driven by a Gaussian in which the rate of deformation of the surface is scaling with the average spiking frequency of the population, okay? And we're encoding synaptic interactions. There's a ring that makes the Mexican hat, but that red is excitation. Blue, you'll see, is inhibition. And the hue, the resolution is probably not so great up here, is scaling exactly with the synaptic dynamics. So it's our way to animate networks, populations, bumps, and hats. Okay, so, and you're going to listen to this cell right here. So here's the dynamics. The important thing, inhibition, critical for pattern formation. Here we go. There's a dynamic tension in the network that's very interesting. Oh yeah, you should, let me loop it. You should see the real. The resolution is horrible on the projection, but it's quite good here. So here's the inspiratory phase, tonic excitation. This is the kernel. It's driving an output element. The kernel activity is subsiding. There are cells that are inhibitory, active during the inspiratory phase. So here we go. Let's watch it again. I'll loop it this time. So you're listening to... You're listening to this cell right here. There's fluctuations that are happening because of the temporal dispersion within a population. These are what we call synaptic traffic lanes. If you want to take a look at this, it looks great on the on this, but not in the... Okay. So that's the end of the story, and I tried to talk about cellular network dynamics in an oscillator and issues of pattern formation. I think we covered a lot. John Rinzel and Butera were important. Koshia for imaging, and there's a number of contributors to this in the Cellular and Systems Neurobiology group. If you're at NIH, come by. There's lots of bells and whistles and things to look at, and I'd be glad to show you around the lab and talk about some dynamics and interact with regard to modeling issues. Okay? Yep.
If you totally remove one single neuron, I mean,
well, you can remove it.
Isolated them chemically, this pharmaceutical.
Yeah. Right.
But if you really physically remove them out of the network.
We haven't done that. I mean, we thought about it. But we can. What we try to do, it's interesting. You have the kernel in the dish you think would be easy to solve this problem, right? No, not so easy, even in the island. So we thought, all right, the geometry is complicated. Can we simplify it? So we tried to grow the island in culture and get the thing to flatten out. The idea would be the network would remain active. You'd end up with a sheet if you were lucky. Everything that wasn't active would die off. It grows nicely. It stays in there, but it flattens out a bit. So it didn't buy us anything, and I didn't like the way the cell looked. So we are trying to do some dissociation on these. I mean, we go through all this stuff of imaging and patching, and you know, this is all technically really intensive to just get at the cells. I mean, I'd love to have layer 5 or, you know, whatever, but you know, that's the challenge, and this is interesting. I mean, you know, we have this embedded system, and I think spatially distributed, there's going to be all these interesting features of geometry to uncover and lots of modeling to overlay. I mean, I think the stuff inspired by this that John and Dave did, which is quite nice. I'd like to see some population abstraction of some of this stuff returning, you know, 25 years, you know, later, but now that we know more, you know, about. And I'd like to see sort of the movies that I just showed you there about the dynamics of the interaction in terms of some other things like, you know, hats and bumps and all that sort of thing, but we have our version. Yep. Yeah.
Well, just, I guess a couple of questions in that. Did you try
Yeah, we put it on a culture well with a membrane filter, and yeah, the reason we did that is because you can it doesn't affect infrared illumination. You can do all the imaging. So yeah, there is that millipore, I think, makes it. I mean, it didn't really buy us anything because we can take and we can cut these slices out and isolate the engine of the system and reliably, and you know, it's more intact and it doesn't get as cultures are bad news. I mean, you know, it gets gnarly looking.
Well, you still have the brainstem slices if you have these afferents that come in there to modulate the rhythm. Can you actually stimulate these afferents, or are they sort of a little hard to track?
There's a couple of interesting systems in there. There's the along the midline is the serotonergic system. You can stimulate it and do neat stuff. You can show plasticity and to the oscillator itself. Give it a shot of serotonin, and you increase the frequency, and you get the equivalent of long-term potentiation. You get a lot of interesting dynamic phenomenon, and we think, in terms of afferent inputs, this is important stuff. And there are people that are modeling. So I've talked about a dynamic plasticity here, the ability, because of the state dependence and the non-linearities, to be able to dynamically transform the different mechanisms of generating a rhythm or a pattern. There's the other issue of the real plasticity associated with the properties of the cells. I mean, this is, you know, you may think, well, breathing is just stereotypical, and, you know, I mean, you know, you actually transform the system, so it's highly plastic. I like the issue of dynamic plasticity myself, and I don't think this has been adequately addressed in very many systems, except for the thalamocortical system is one nice example where the state dependence of things, again, seems to be important and has real functional implications. You shift cells from an oscillatory burst mode to a beating mode, and this really affects, potentially, if the ideas are right, the transmission of sensory information through this net that's in one state or another. And it's dynamically transformable by neurochemicals. And so I was just mentioning that we have the serotonergic system. Piece of the RAFA is sitting in the slice and you can activate it. Look at modulation and there's plasticity. So you get, like, at the network level, long-term potentiation of the oscillation, if you kick it.
The glial network has an important.
Yes. Absolutely important. There was a paper that I just took a look at where people are starting to analyze the glial types and their properties with patch clamping. There's glia in there. There's the three classic types based on a category. But the point is with glia can do things. They take up glutamate, so this is an excitatory network. They damp potassium oscillation, so when this network gets active, there's a lot of potassium that's potentially getting dumped. That's a variable that's not been in any of these models. People have modeled this in other systems. I think the glia are very important. I don't know, you know, yet how, but certainly, I mean, glia is important for.
That can release glutamate.
Yes.
And that's
glutamate. Yeah, but because of the potassium conductances and their ability, they have glutamate transporters. You know, they're nice sinks. You know, they sit there and they can mop up this stuff. Yeah, there's some tonic excitation that's going on in this network, even in the slice, that keeps it revved up and oscillating. And there's even some tonic inhibition that's going on here. And the glutamate, the background glutamate, it's dribbling out of synapses, but it may be leaking out of...
That's why I was asking the question.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's a good... Yep.
Yeah, so you haven't talked about how to shut down the network. Do you have to inhibit every neuron?
Well, so this is interesting. So in the hybrid model, remember we had the kernel, it was embedded, the kernel sitting there oscillating, but the pattern-forming network can transform it, but it can oscillate by itself. Now you set it up into a dynamic configuration where you're getting the driven pattern formation, and I like that idea that you said the other day. It's driven pattern formation under those conditions. If you block the activity of the pre-Botzinger complex under those conditions, the network will come to a crashing halt because you're taking away your driver for pattern formation, okay? But if you then elevate the excitation, this was what had to happen in those simulations to demonstrate the feasibility of the dynamic states, then on this remaining network, elevate the tonic excitation, and because of the ring structure, it'll start oscillating on its own. Okay, so to inhibit activity, it depends upon the state. And I don't know whether the brain uses this. It may. Think about this. Conscious states, there's a whole barrage of various inputs onto a system like this. Well, what about during sleep? So I don't know. I may be operating in my dynamically transformed non-pacemaker-driven state right now because of the necessity for the kinds of modulations. Modulation required to integrate this behavior with other behaviors, but during sleep, you know, I want a nice, you know, pacemaker-driven system, perhaps. I don't know. So that's maybe a state-dependent change in the brain that's associated with state-dependent dynamics. And it wouldn't surprise me. But you can always stop the system. And that's why we think the pre-Botzinger complex is so important, because it appears to be a node where you can really stop the system. And I didn't mention that there are, or drive the system. Encoded in the pattern-forming network is everything the thing needs to do to generate the pattern. If I drive it, it's going to come out of my neural machine for behavior. Even though it has oscillation, that oscillation capability of that network may not simply be redundancy. I think there's dynamic meaning, there's robustness to the system that way. It introduces a whole new level of dynamics of coupled, you know, complicated oscillatory networks, but you can still stop the system, I think, through the pre-Botzinger complex node. So you remove that drive and output. And if the brain wants to generate an oscillation, then, I mean, you know, this is the nerve vitale, the node of life, what the French physiologists, you have, that's the name for the center of breathing that people started way back with Aristotle You remove that, and you can't breathe, but, you know, the brain can excite what's left and get an oscillation, maybe. Maybe it's used that way. But given the different dynamics and the different states, it wouldn't surprise me that the brain is taking advantage of this configurational changeability of the system.
On that note,
yep. Let's look for...
All the sessions will close up.